tiles. They looked like they had skinny little off-white clouds swirling in the linoleum. His captors were not only stupid, but they had bad taste. His left eye was black, and his lip was swollen. He held a wet cloth to it and winced. He prodded at his tooth with the tip of his tongue. He thought it might be loose. His hair spikes were all plastered down flat, and if he could have looked in a mirror, he would have been appalled to see he looked like Julius Caesar with his tiny blonde bangs sticking to his forehead. Tacho put his hands on his belly and surreptitiously felt his money belt. He couldn't believe these morons hadn't taken it and discovered his dollars. Good for him, though. They would have really thought he was a terrorist with all that cash. As it was, they had given him a good tune-up, bouncing his body on the floor and accidentally running his head into the wall. An American in a badly fitting black suit came in the room and set a manila folder on the table and smiled as he sat. "Mr. Laura," he said. "Hmm," said Tacho, looking away angrily. "Do you speak English?"
"Sure. I speak good English."
"Fine." The fellow opened the file, moved three papers around, cleared his throat. Tacho sneered. The guy was wearing musk cologne. That was for 13-year-old boys. Tacho would have recommended Aramis and a serious haircut.
"Yes, well, there was certainly a misunderstanding here."
"Yes."
"You understand that the heightened security demands of the post-9/11 world, blah, blah, blah."
"And mine ass get kicked pretty good by gringos," Tacho interrupted.
"I cannot agree with your assessment. Perhaps there was involuntary roughness in your apprehension."
"It's not a soccer game, Gray."
"No, it is not. However, you were already guilty of entering the country illegally, and when you blurted the name of a terrorist organization..."
"Mierda!" Tacho cried. "It's name of my restaurant."
"Ahem."
They had actually called around Sinaloa and found that La Mano Caída was indeed a cantina of some sort, owned and operated by Mr. Laura. The information on his Mexican driver's license corresponded to his official domicile, so now they had to make sure the forms were in order. These days, even illegals were litigious.
"Although you will be returned to Mexico, we would like to extend our apologies for any harm you might have accidentally suffered when resisting arrest."
Tacho smiled. "The bastard." He nodded. The man rose and walked briskly from the room. A Migra agent stepped in and crooked a finger. Tacho followed him.
"Are you going to lodge a complaint?" the agent asked in Spanish.
"No."
"Are you going to cross again?"
"Yes."
They got to the bus.
"All right," the Border Patrol man said. "See you next week."
"See you,"
Tacho called as he boarded the bus. Back in Tijuana, in the dark, he called Aunt Irma.
"Nayeli's gone to Matt's house," Irma told him.
"Really?"
Tacho said. "That is the plan."
"So they made it?"
"I don't know."
"What is Matt's phone number?"
"I don't know."
"Well, mi hija, what do you know? Because I am calling you to find out, and you aren't telling me anything."
"Now, now."
"Don't now me."
"Tacho, get a grip on yourself. Now, tell me, what will you do?"
"I don't know."
Laosa spit a small curse. I will go to San Diego, he said, somehow. I can't let my girls do their business alone.
Good boy, said Irma.
Tacho rubbed his face. Cross the border again. That was just great, just what he wanted to do. Tacho sighed. He had a little crust of blood around the rim of his nostril. He flicked it away with a fingernail.
Has my restaurant gone out of business yet? He said.
Not yet, but it currently lacks your feminine touch, Irma replied.
Look, don't start with me, Doña. I am in no mood for your pendejadas. I've been arrested, I've been beat up, I've been deported, and I am not going to listen to your homophobic comments. Oh, no. Eso sí que no. Not tonight.
But Irma, of course, had already hung up. The taxi driver did not bat an eyelash when Tacho told him, "Take me to a gay bar." How he had longed to visit a gay bar, to drop his guard for just an hour, to laugh with men who did not laugh at him. He was afraid for just an instant that the taxi driver would tell him there weren't any gay bars in Tijuana. But the driver merely mentioned two, and Tacho sat back, closed his eyes, and said, "Take me to the nicest one." It wasn't far from the Palacio Azteca Hotel. The front had a kind of Mediterranean motif. Neon tubes ran up the sides of the building, causing the crenellations in the salmon stucco to glow like hot sheets of glass. He was terribly underdressed and dirty, but he didn't care. He could hear the music coming out the door. He could hear laughter, smell cigars and cigarettes. Inside, he let the dark and the lights and the heavy bass wash over him. They were playing Justice and Kid 606. A bar gleamed invitingly under amber lights at the far end of the room. He let it pull him through the crowd. He had earned a drink. Several drinks. He met Rigoberto at the far end of the Rosewood Bar as he leaned over a green apple martini and swayed to the comforting music. The men around him smelled good. Hugo and Versace. People who understood him. Some place that felt safe. He downed the first martini and resisted the approach of a sad sack in very bad makeup and false eyelashes. The guy actually had a beauty mark blotted on his lip with eyebrow pencil.
"Not tonight," Tacho said.
A handsome middle-aged Mexican man nodded to him as he pushed into the bar.
"Hello, señorita," the man said to the makeup queen, who went away unhappily.
Tacho accepted his second martini from the bartender.
"Do you smoke?"
The man offered him a black cigarette. Tacho shook his head.
"It's a Sherman," the man said. "Chocolate."
"Chocolate?"
"The best cigarette ever."
Tacho took it.
"I shouldn't," he said.
"But you will." The man fired up his smoke with a lapis lighter and lit his own and dropped the lighter in his jacket pocket.
"Muy rico," Tacho said.
"I told you so." The man gestured at the bartender. He didn't have to order. The barkeep nodded.
"Who are you?" the man asked.
"Tacho."
"A wanderer."
Tacho nodded.
"Yes, I'm a stranger here."
The man laughed.
"Brother," he said, "this is Tijuana. Everybody's a stranger."
He put his hand out. "Rigoberto," he said. "Call me Rigo." Tacho shook his hand.
"Pleased," he said,
swoony. The martinis and the exhaustion were just about knocking him over. Rico sat on the stool next to him and stared at his face.
What? Tacho said.
Your face, said Rico.
He received a Johnny Walker Blue, one rock. Tacho raised his eyebrows. He had good taste, this Rigoberto. He didn't approve of the ice, though. A waste of space in the glass, in his opinion.
I've looked better, Tacho said.
Oh, you look good, Rigo answered. Just beat up.
The border patrol.
Oh, Rigoberto said, a bit of distaste in his voice. You're a border crosser.
Tacho laughed.
You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Try me.
So he told. Rigo listened with his head cocked to one side. He kept a small smile on his face the whole time. He sipped his whiskey and crunched the ice cube.
You're kidding, he said when Tacho was done.
Tacho shook his head.
Look at this trash I'm wearing, he said. I look good in the real world. Would I go out looking like this if I hadn't just escaped with my life?
Rigoberto laughed.
Everybody around Tacho was dressed well. The men danced and chatted and laughed. Tacho felt the sweet liquor move out his arms, down his legs, relaxing him almost as much as the men's laughter. Rigoberto gestured at them. Professors, lawyers, office managers, the cream of Tijuana. He ordered another drink. You're the only criminal in here. He grinned. Very exotic. Tacho didn't think a third green apple martini was a good idea, but Rigoberto pointed at his glass and nodded at the barkeep, and it was refilled.
It's boring tonight, Rigo said. So slow. If you want to have fun anymore, you have to go to San Diego.
Tell me about it.
Rigoberto regarded this mysterious stranger with a crazy dye job. He liked Tacho. There was a certain aplomb about him, but he'd have to get him in some better clothes.
God, Tacho said.
What?
I feel like I'm home.
Home?
We don't, Tacho smiled ruefully. We don't gather where I come from. We don't have clubs.
Ah.
It's nice.
Tacho felt his eyes sting a little. He was more tired than he thought, he told himself.
Rigoberto raised his glass to Tacho.
Salud, he said.
Tacho tapped his glass to Rigoberto's.
By the way, Rigo said, I'm a doctor. I could look at that eye. And that big fat lip.
He smiled.
What a sly one, Tacho thought.
You want to do something about my lip, he said.
I could. It's a bit swollen.
Smiling.
You're devilish, Tacho said. Aren't you, Rigo?
Devilish? I am indeed. Incarnate.
They bumped knees.
Tacho could not believe that in his state, as tired as he was, as sad and fed up and physically sore, Rigo was getting him turned on.
Let's go, Rigo said.
Where?
We can go to your place, Rigo said.
Tacho snorted.
I'd have to take you to Sinaloa.
Ah, right.
Or back to the border patrol station.
Por Dios.
Rigoberto gave the barkeep a credit card and pointed at both their glasses.
"Allow me," he said.
He signed the chit and stood.
"I suppose," he said, "we will have to go to my house, you know, to attend to your lip."
Good Lord! Tacho followed Rigo, and was deeply gratified to settle into the leather seat of Rigoberto's fat BMW. Chet Baker came on the CD changer. Tacho closed his eyes. He was snoring before they'd left downtown and headed into the posh hills to the southeast. When Rigoberto woke him, he thought for a moment he'd gone home. They were surrounded by hibiscus, bougainvillea, birds of paradise, lantana, sago palms, and small pine trees. The whole lush jungle was backlit by red and blue spotlights.
"Welcome," Rigoberto said.
Tacho asked, "May I take a shower?"
Rigoberto replied, "Thank you. I was about to say, would you please take a shower?"
They walked into his house, laughing. Chapter 22.
"Nayeli, she's hot," Atomico whispered.
"So is Yolo," Matt replied.
Atomico had never given up the couch. Matt had dragged his mattress out of his room, and Nayeli was in there, sleeping on the box spring in a mattress pad. Yolo and Vampi had pulled apart Ma's bed and were jammed in the other bedroom. The two men were drunk and giggling like Boy Scouts. Matt couldn't believe his Spanish had returned so easily, though his accent was atrocious. Atomico didn't care. He was enjoying his own mastery of English. They were speaking some conglomerate pidgin. He'd downed 8 tecates, and Matt could have been speaking Chinese. They found a bottle of Ma's tequila, and Matt was veering toward cactus juice visions.
"Chingado," Atomico sighed as he gulped a shot of Cuervo.
"Thank you, Jesus," said Matt. This struck them as hilarious, and they buried their faces in their pillows and guffawed. A door opened in the dark.
"Uh-oh," said Matt.
Yolo came out, wearing one of Matt's t-shirts. It barely covered her nether regions. They could see her in the streetlight glow, luminescent in the hallway.
"Mora," Atomico growled. "Hurt me, damage me, put me in the hospital."
"Would you," Yolo said, "please, I'm being nice, please, be quiet so we can get some sleep?"
"I'll help you sleep," Atomico said.
She went back and shut the door decisively.
"Oh my God," Matt noted.
They snorted into their pillows some more.
"Hey, gringo," Atomico said. "Don't you got any shorter t-shirts?"
They screamed into their pillows for a minute. The door opened.
"I mean it!"
That was even funnier than whatever they'd found funny a minute ago.
"You are such idiots," Yolo said.
The door slammed.
"One time," Atomico said, "there was this chick named Alma Rosa. She was hanging out at the Dompe when the missionaries came around. I used to help the gringos give out beans and potatoes. Alma Rosa took me back by her father's pigsty and showed me her chichis. Can you believe that? I guess she wanted more beans."
Matt lay on his back, staring into the dark.
"I'm lost," he announced.
"Huh?" Atomico replied.
"You're drunk."
"No. Yeah, I know I'm drunk, but
It's deeper, dude. It's like I'm lost.
Ah.
They listened to the muffled and sparse traffic going down Clearmont Drive. The Mongols were in residence next door. They could hear the TV going. Atomico farted explosively.
"Did you hear a duck quack?" he said.
There was a thump on the bedroom wall.
"Yolo threw a shoe," Matt noted.
"The world," Atomico proclaimed, moved to alcoholic profundity, "is lost.
Not just you, Matteo. Look at it, Vato. Look at the ice caps, at the Pinches Arabs. Look at, the border and shit like that."
Matt could not drink anymore. He put the bottle down and gave up trying to find the cap in the dark.
"Grrf,"
he said.
"Me?" Atomico continued. "I was a soldier. That's right. I was in the Mexican army. I was a sergeant. But so what? Everybody in the Mexican army is a sergeant. My real name is Kiko. My mother called me that. But that was me, soldier. How you think I became a warrior? You think I can't kill everybody? I can kill everybody. I can kill the Pinches Mongols right now. I'll go over there and do it."
He struggled symbolically to rise from the couch, then lay back down.
"In a minute," he said. "So how'd you end up in the garbage dump?" Matt asked. "I got caught stealing a chicken."
This suddenly struck them both as hilarious. After a while, Atomico said,
"It's not big deal. Everybody in the Mexican army steals chickens. But I was illegal in San Isidro."
"Wow.
Mexicano army don't like that."
"Yeah, no."
"You steal chickens?"
"Not so much."
"The Mexican army, they teach us English. Why I speak so good? Army. And they no pay in pesos, Mateo. They pay in gringo dollars."
"The Mexican army pays in dollars?" Matt managed to say, though his lips were completely numb.
"Hell yes. In Tijuana is all English and dollars. They know where everybody's going when they get out."
"I'm going to sleep."
"Me too.
But first, I'm gonna think about YOLO in that t-shirt."
"Me too."
They chuckled and sputtered themselves to sleep. The girls crept around in the morning, doing their laundry in Ma Johnston's little washer-dryer in the alcove by the back door. Nayeli and Yolo wore Matt's t-shirts and nothing else. They were quiet because they couldn't bear the boys looking under their hems. Vampi had found Ma Johnston's tatty bathrobe. She was a sight. Goth-eyed and raven-haired in an unraveling quilted puce wrap. The dryer banged and rattled, but it didn't wake the guys. The girls nudged each other and laughed. Atomico slept like he'd been shot in the head, and he had his right hand stuffed into his boxers. Matt was a lump on the floor. He had his head buried under his pillow. One-fourth of his bum cleavage protruded whitely from his blue-checkered boxers. The girls were dressed and drinking instant coffee before the guys even moved. Atomico snorted, sat up and glared at them, rubbed his shaved head. He rose like a zombie and kicked Matt.
"Pancakes," he said.
He staggered toward the bathroom, scratching his ass. He stood peeing with the door open. Nayeli went over and shut it. She shook her head. "What a pig," she muttered. Matt sat up. His blonde hair stood up all over his head. His eyes were puffy. He smiled like sunrise. Nayeli wanted to kiss him and climb under his blankets with him. "Good morning, beautiful," he said. She thrilled. "Hi, gorgeous," he said to Yolo, who still acted angry with him over last night, but secretly smiled. Nayeli studied this stratagem. How did she do that? How did she scowl and smile at the same time? How did she know what angle worked best when she glanced sideways like that? Nayeli's face just broke into her crazy smile and made her look like a clown.
"Buenos dias, you goddess," he said to Vampi.
Vampi didn't waste time worrying about how to deal with Matt. She walked over and plopped down beside him and pulled the covers over herself. She looked up at him and smiled.
"Hello, handsome," she said.
"Damn," Nayeli thought. "Just like a puppy." Atomiko yelled from the bathroom, "Pancakes!"
"Que son pancakes?" Vampi asked. They were in the minivan, tooling down the street.
"Son yokeks," Yolo said. "Yokeks? ¿Qué es eso?"
They passed the Vaughn's Market, where Mai used to shop, and the library where she got her books, and they swung around a wide bend and were delighted to see the sweep of Mission Bay before them. It looked like Mazatlan.
Atomiko said, "Los yokeks son panquequis."
"¿Qué?"
Nayeli said, "It's like a tortilla, Vampi." Matt was laughing.
"You put syrup on them. Butter, you know?"
"No."
"They put blueberries in them, or chocolate chips."
"Blueberries and syrup on a tortilla? Guacala! I will have huevos rancheros."
They pulled into the little strip mall at the bottom of the hill. There was the jack-in-the-box they'd eaten at 10 hours ago.
"I've been there," Atomiko said.
"You're a local," Matt said. "Leave your pole here, though." They walked into the restaurant. It was full of fat and happy Americans. Old duffers with white baseball caps cracked wise with the waitresses. The waitresses had stiffly sprayed hairdos and frilly skirts. The Camarones crew goggled. Paintings of rampant stags and soaring eagles graced the walls. It was still 1965 in the restaurant, but they didn't know that.
"Hi, doll," a waitress whose bosom proclaimed Velma said. "Haven't seen you for a while."
"You know," Matt said, "my mom and all."
"Hey, we were so sorry to hear about that. It was real sad."
"Thanks."
"Five?" she said.
"Yep." She snagged 5 plastic-covered menus out of a slot in the counter and whisked them to a corner booth.
"Booth all right?"
"Great, thanks."
"Who's your friends?" she said as they sat.
"They're old friends from the mission field."
"Oh, missionaries."
It was too hard to explain, so Matt just smiled up at her.
"Mexicans?"
Matt nodded.
"Welcome to the United States!" Velma shouted at them as if they were deaf.
Everyone smiled warmly, wondering if she was mad at them.
"You'll have to meet El Brujo. He's around here someplace."
Vampi looked up. "El Brujo? There was someone here named the Wizard?"
"Get you some coffee?" Velma asked.
Everyone nodded.
"Please,"
Matt said. 5 coffees, coming right up, doll.
They stared out the big window at the spotless USA. People lined up across the street for $5 gas. No dogs anywhere. Skateboarders zoomed by on their way downhill. El Brujo appeared, carrying 5 waters. Vampi turned and froze. He wore an apron. He was as short as she was. His black hair was pulled back and hung in a heavy ponytail. She saw a dragon in the swirl of ink on his arms, but his t-shirt, his t-shirt! Nayeli nudged Yolo. They stared at the man as he put the glasses down, then went to retrieve 5 silverware setups from his cart. The shirt was black, the 69 eyes in red across the chest. "Oh, no," Yolo said. "Vampi?" warned Nayeli. But Vampi was deaf to them. Vampi was turned in her seat. Vampi's mouth hung open. El Brujo put down the napkin-wrapped forks and knives and glanced at Vampi. At the apartment, she had done her eyes in fresh death makeup. He smiled a little at her. He looked like an Aztec warrior.
"Soy una vampira," she whispered.
El Brujo did a double take. "Ay, cabrón," he said. The other girls were out of practice. They didn't remember how fast Mexican romances moved. By that evening, El Brujo had arrived at Matt's duplex and swept Vampi off on a date. He drove a 71 Chevy pickup that had an Eros del Silencio decal in the back window. The girls were stunned and jealous. "Just like that," they kept saying. "Just like that." "We didn't come here to get boyfriends," Nayeli said. "We are not here to go on dates," Yolo agreed. "We're on a mission. We can't fool around with boys. We came to save 3 camarones. Matt came in the kitchen.
"Hola, Mateo," Nayeli cooed.
"Ay, Matt," sang Yolo.
"How are you?" Nayeli asked in English.
"Fuvajou?"
"Matt," Yolo cried.
He looked at them and smiled and got some water and went back out to watch wrestling with Atomico.
"Vampi," Nayeli said, "is out of control."
"She'd better get her priorities right," Yolo agreed. They sat in the pickup truck on Mount Soledad. The lights of San Diego were scattered before them. Rivers of high beams and taillights beneath them on I-5. The bizarre hair-thin beacon of a laser kept shooting over the mountain, some sort of urban art project. In the distance, the icy-looking white spires of a Mormon temple, and above them, the shining white cross Vampi had first seen when she jumped out of the smuggler's truck. Had it been yesterday? Was that all? Every day seemed a week long to her. She watched the lights of a jet as it descended in the distance.
"It's magic, isn't it?" El Brujo said.
"It's the prettiest thing I ever saw," she replied.
"You must not have looked in the mirror this morning," he said. "Oh, Brujo."
Lovers were parked all around them. Music and smoke snaked out of cracked, foggy windows. El Brujo, his real name was Alejandro, but everybody called him Alex, kept the radio tuned to the mighty 690, and he sang along softly when a good song came on. Vampi sat beside him with her fingers laced through his, rubbing his knuckles with her thumb. She looked at his ferocious profile,
his luxuriant hair. He had let it down for her. His hoop earring made him look like a pirate. Sometimes, she was thinking, you just know. Did he know, too? People don't believe it because of the way I look, he said, but I don't take drugs, and I don't drink. Me neither. I don't smoke. Me neither. He leaned over and smelled her hair. You are my drug, Vampira.
Oh, Alex.
She furiously buffed his knuckles with her thumb.
This hill, he said, this is where all the rich bastards live.
Oh?
Part of the hill fell down, on the other side. It swallowed a bunch of their mansions.
He smiled.
God reminded them to be humble.
Vampi sighed. She scooted closer and put her head on his shoulder.
Besides, he continued, they'll hire a bunch of Mexicans to fix it for them.
She raised his knuckles to her lips and rubbed them against her mouth.
We'll live up here one day, he added.
She felt a jolt.
We will?
She fell upon his chest. He was quiet for a moment.
Probably not, he admitted.
But we can make it magic wherever we are. Right? She was speaking into his collarbone. She wanted to nibble it. He put his arm around her.
I must have done something right, he said, for you to come into my life.
And he won her heart forever in that instant, for he broke into song. His voice was deep, a rich baritone, and he sang it. He sang, just like a Gothic girl, lost in the darkened world. Vampi started to cry.
Christ, I love you, he sang.
Alex knew.
My little Gothic girl.
He knew. He had come north from León, Guanajuato. He was a guitarist for a dark wave metal band in Mexico known as Cuernos de Huelo. But there was no money in Guanajuato for a dark wave band. So Alex's family was hurting. His dad had retired, and his mom was caring for him with little money. So Alex had sought his fortunes in Los Unaites. Isn't that where all the big metal bands came from? Black Sabbath, for example. No, wait. Sabbath was from England. Cradle of Filth, maybe. England again. He gestured to his shirt, but Vampi just smiled sweetly. The 69 eyes were from Helsinki, maybe, some pagan Viking Nosferatu place.
I think they worship Odin, she noted.
To his astonishment, Alex found out that there was not much market for an undocumented Aztec death shredder without a guitar and without any English at all. He thought anybody could become a rock star in the USA. He thought you got on MTV and got rich. He thought he'd be opening for Motley Crue on a world tour. He didn't think you hid from authorities and felt the Americans' eyes pass right through you in the supermarket. If nobody could even see him, how was he going to get famous? It took him a year or two to admit that he never would get famous. He might never play in a band again. He fell into the slums in Logan Heights, southeast of the city, then worked his way up to a Taco Bell in Pacific Beach. He'd shared an apartment with five other chavalos from Chiapas and Guerrero. They were gardeners. They ate lunch at the pancake house one day and saw the cardboard sign in the window seeking busboys.
They told Alex, and he found himself in the happy family of Velma and her duffers. He'd been at the pancake house now for 6 years. His dad was dead.
"May he rest in peace," Vampi said.
Alex turned and looked into her eyes and kissed her savagely, unable to contain himself. He had some money put away, but he was afraid to go to the funeral, so he'd sent it all to his mom via La Western Union.
"Now what?" she asked.
"I don't know. I've got this truck. I guess I'll work 6 more years. She nuzzled him. He smiled down at her. This sweet-smelling girl. She was so soft, so warm. She was better than $1 million right there in his truck. Alex hadn't been with a woman in, well, it had been a long time. He wasn't sure what to do.
"Are you my girl?" he asked. "Is it crazy?" she said. "Is it too soon?"
"You might as well ask the moon," he said. "You might as well ask the stars." In Vampi's opinion, Alex spoke in song lyrics. The La Jolla laser came back on and shot a vivid emerald beam over their heads. It seemed like a sign. Everything seemed like a sign to Vampi.
"My real name is Veronica," she confessed.
She climbed into his lap and kissed his mouth. She sat on the horn and startled all the lovers. The honk echoed down the hill. She grabbed 2 hands full of hair and gazed into his eyes.
"You could come back home with me," she said.
And she told him her story. Matt and Yolo looked in the phone book. "S. Chavarin," he called out. "S," Yolo said. "Must stand for Salvador, you think? Jutin?" "Si," Nayeli said. "Salvador Chava, that must be him." "La Osa's boyfriend," said Yolo.
"No, you think so?"
"Yeah." Matt and Atomico didn't know what the fuss was all about.
"You do it," Nayeli said.
Yolo smiled nervously and punched the numbers. It rang 3 times. She scrunched her nose at Nayeli. A man answered.
"Hello?"
"Señor Chavarin?" Yolo asked.
"Yes?"
"We are from Tres Camarones," she said.
"¿Qué?"
"Tres Camarones. We have come from there and we represent Irma Garcia Cervantes."
"Dios mío."
"She is the mayor of Camarones," Yolo reported. He gasped.
"Mayor? Irma?"
"She asked us to call you." He said,
"I have to sit down."
Don Chava worked the night shift at the Hillcrest Bowl. He didn't want them to go there. Yolo could hear the tone in his voice. She thought it was embarrassment. What was there to be embarrassed about? She herself worked at the Camarones bowling alley. She promised to call him in the morning. She hung up.
"What's he like?" Nayeli asked.
"Sad," Yolo replied. "Old?" "Nice." She twisted the phone cord around her fingers. "He told me where he works, but he doesn't want us to come." Nayeli said,
"Do you really think he's Aunt Irma's boyfriend?"
Yolo smiled. "Once upon a time. God, Nayeli, he almost had a heart attack when I mentioned her name."
"Really?"
"Yeah." They grinned at each other.
"Let's go see him," Nayeli said.
Let's.
They turned to the guys.
Mateo, they sang in their sweetest voices. Are you busy?
Chapter 23. Salvador Chava Chavarin owned the first clear bowling ball in Sinaloa. It was pale orange, and it could have been a jewel. Nobody could roll the ball like Chava. He released the ball like a dancer, his arm rising and cutting across his face and holding there as his slim hips seemed to steer the ball to yet another strike. Oh, yes, Chava Chavarin was Irma's guru. She followed him to the lanes in Mazatlan, Acoponeta, and Los Mochis. When he had a bowling shirt stitched Americano style, she saved up her money and sent away for a real American shirt from Los Angeles. His shirt had orange piping on a blue and white two-tone plaquette with his name over his heart. Hers was silver and black and featured a lurid 15,000 thread stitching of a ball smashing pins against a white inset. It was Chava who introduced Irma to the cinema. When she was a girl, she was a tomboy. She was always busy swimming in the river, or crabbing, or climbing the mango and date trees to get fruit. Things like music and movies didn't catch her eye at all. Until she saw Chava squiring puff-skirted young ladies to the movies. He was exquisite. His mustache was a thin line of inexpressible suggestiveness over his sharp yet tender upper lip. He smoked cigarettes in holders that jutted from his mouth like an old-time Yankee president's. He had FDR in mind. He saved every cent he earned and spent it on finery, his bowling winnings making him increasingly dapper. And since he lived with his mother, he had money to burn. Plus, she kept his clothes washed and ironed. He even wore a white dinner jacket. He carried a flask of rum and a silver cigarette case, and he tapped his cigarettes on the case 3 times, sass, 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 before he inserted them in the holder. He lit the lady's smokes with a gold Zippo that appeared with the Fred Astaire flick of the hand that revealed a faux Cartier watch on his wrist, and it glittered with paste diamonds. He was always laughing, and everybody in town called him That Chava, as in, oh, that Chava, he's too much. Sometimes, when he walked down the street, he was so deep into his own rhythm that he snapped his fingers and shuffled a tiny sideways dance, keeping the beat. Irma, feeling fat and awkward, slunk into the cinema and watched Chava more than the movies. She writhed with envy, the way he put his arm around whatever tramp he was escorting. He would cool them both with a paper fan on a stick. The fans, distributed by the beer dealer, featuring blurry black and white photographs of great stars like Lola Beltran. It was so gallant. Of course, in those days, nobody dared kiss in public. But was there any doubt, when Chava got his fan going, that he was going to reap great kisses from his various concubines? Everyone assumed he was a devil with the lights out. It made Irma feverish just thinking about it. Her moment of glory came in a rush, in a 12-lane bowling alley with a layer of cigar smoke hovering 2 feet below the ceiling, and the sound of a brass band punching the tuba and trumpet cacophony as sweat poured down her back. It was on the epochal night of the mixed men's and women's state bowling finals in Culiacan. Chava had gone down in flames to an upstart from El Rosario. There was no catching the blonde bomber, Beto Murray, damn him. So Chava nursed his disgrace and was free to sit in the Camarones section,
among the women who had gathered to cheer Irma. And she was magnificent. Just the hot sensation of his stare burning, finally, into her rump, sent her hurtling down the lane. His gaze tingled her bottom and lifted her onto her tiptoes. Her throws were devastating. The pins seemed to shatter into toothpicks as she scored strike after strike after strike. Magnificent Irma! Chava rose. He cheered. He shouted. When she won, he leaped over the rail between them and lifted her off the floor in a wild embrace. Irma had not believed a man could lift her. It was disconcerting, yet thrilling. They made love for the first time in Chava's car, pulled off the road in a huge bean field. Cicadas bombed the car, and worried Brahma bulls sniffed the windows. He was Irma's first and only. Frankly, it didn't feel all that great, and it left a mess. Chava, stylish even with his white skivvies around his ankles, produced a silk hanky and cleaned Irma with it. An act of tenderness she would never forget. But more than the feeling of Chava's hands carefully blotting her with the cool silk, Irma would always remember the hazy half-moon out the back window. Ever after, when she saw the full moon wane, she grew melancholy. If she'd had any musical gifts, she would have sung ballads to the sky. Chava ran a small shrimp boat out of the estuaries. In the off-season, he fished for tuna and flounder and occasionally drove a truck. It was on a long-haul mango and banana run that he lost his head and broke Irma's heart. He drove the ancient Dodge stake bed to Tijuana. He'd been to Tijuana before. What touring bowler hadn't? But he startled them all by not returning. Perhaps they should have seen it as a harbinger of their future migratory fate. That Chava was always ahead of the curve. There it was, 1964, and he was already gone north. He sent word that he'd found work. He'd found a cheap house and a good-paying job, and he was going to apply for a green card and work in the tuna canneries of San Diego. His letters and telegrams to Irma were full of innocence and joy. Amazing tales of bright American days and clean American beaches. Shining American bowling alleys. When he went on a small tour, he showered her with postcards of bowling alleys in Tucumcari, New Mexico, El Paso, Texas, Benson, Arizona. When it came time for her to bowl in the north of Mexico, the year of 1965, she went to Chava on a Mexicana flight, clutching a shiny black purse and wearing high heels for the first time in her life. She was expecting a wedding. But Chava had stayed in El Norte for other reasons. True, the cannery paid him well. His little yellow house in the bucolic hills of Colonia Independencia was cute. His sly smuggling of Irma into the U.S. for her San Diego bowling premiere was memorable. But he'd been oddly chaste with her, even distant. And in the end, he had sent her home with a mere peck on the cheek. Only when she was back in Tres Camarones did Irma hear from Chava's mother that he had impregnated an American woman. A blonde, no less. A cocktail waitress from the Aztec Lanes in San Diego. Chava was marrying her. That was the end of Irma. That day. La Osa, her alter ego, appeared in all her relentless glory to inspire chagrin and penance in the homeland. Matt drove them to Hillcrest. Yolo had nabbed the shotgun seat, and Nayeli beamed smiles at him from the back.
Their overwhelming girl sense filled the minivan. He was baffled by the whole visitation. What did they want? It was what the ZZs would have called a for sure blow mind. Atomiko was sprawled in the third row, snoring again. Matt had the address on a scrap of paper. They took I-5 south to Washington and cut up the hill. The Hillcrest Bowl was across the street from a shabby little medical tower. They pulled into the lot. It was mostly empty. Atomiko stayed asleep in the back seat. A drunk street person addressed them in some ancient Babylonian tongue. Matt handed him a dollar, and they moved away from him. Nayeli put her arm through Matt's as they walked in the bowling alley. She had this way of looking up at him from under her brows that made him happy. The old sound of bowling washed over them like a tide, the rumble crash of balls and pins. Matt heard Patsy Cline playing on the jukebox. It must have been a law in America that every bowling alley installed Crazy, Walkin' After Midnight, and I Fall to Pieces on their jukes. At the main desk, they asked after Chava. "Who?" the guy said.
"Señor Chava," Nayeli repeated.
The guy looked at her. He turned and yelled, "Hey, Sal, you know anybody named Chavez?"
"Chava," Nayeli corrected.
"Whatever." They looked over at Sal. He was carrying a rubber bucket and a mop out of the women's toilet. He wore blue rubber kitchen gloves that reached almost to his elbows. He wore thick-soled work shoes, and his gray trousers were pressed. His white shirt was buttoned up to his neck. Without the pomade, his hair had gone back to its tight curls. Except it had become white, as had his little mustache. He looked at them with a frozen half-smile on his face. Nayeli stepped forward.
"Don Chava?" she asked.